Institutions of higher education in the United States are unique and complicated from a financial perspective. They derive revenue from a wide variety of sources and make expenditures on a wide variety of things. In the studio to help us get an understanding of how universities function is Park City local Randy Livingston, who has had a long and distinguished career in consulting, business, and ultimately as the chief financial officer of Stanford University. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Randy, and thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, Roger. Happy to be here.
So let's start by giving the audience a quick sense of who you are in your career path. How did you end up in academia?
Well, the time that I spent at Stanford as an undergraduate and graduate student, I got to know a number of faculty very, very well and always thought, wow, this would be an idyllic place to work someday. But then I went off and spent much of my career, as you indicated, consulting. I spent 16 years in Silicon Valley working for a variety of different startup companies and had really given up any thought of higher education. And in the summer of 2000, in a movie theater, I ran into a colleague that I worked at a startup company, asked him what he was doing, and he told me he had just gone to work at Stanford. And I told him, wow, I always thought that would be such an idyllic place to work someday. And he said, well, it's funny you should say that because I got an email last week indicating that Stanford had just started a search for a new chief financial officer. And that strange happenstance led to an initial interview. And 4 months later, the president of Stanford hired me. And now 25 years later, I've retired from that role.
Wow, 25 years at Stanford, that's fantastic. 4 months of getting hired.
Yeah, universities tend to move pretty slowly in hiring. And so there were multiple times in the interview process where I hadn't heard from them for several weeks and just assumed that they had picked another candidate and someone would call and say, oh, I hope you're still interested. Would you come in for another interview?
Before we get into sort of a discussion about university, let's talk a little bit big picture about the sort of what you would characterize as the major categories of the kinds of universities.
Yeah, I mean, higher education is an incredibly diverse industry, if you could call it that. I mean, there are huge numbers of community colleges or junior colleges in different areas that their major focus is really in education. Very often they're serving part-time students, individuals that are later in their careers that are doing this to try and gain specific career skills. Then there's a slew of public colleges and universities that tend to educate thousands of students. Private small colleges, places like Williams or Amherst, that do a phenomenal job. And then Stanford is part of a cadre of what are called research universities. And where research universities are different is that a big part of the activity of the university is actually doing fundamental research in all kinds of different disciplines, whether it be biological sciences, engineering, technology, politics, government, economics, and so forth. And those research universities also typically have many, many graduate students, usually more graduate students than they do undergraduates.
Let's talk about, with respect to a major university, what are the sort of sources of revenues? I mean, you know, it's hard to think of a university as a classic business because it's not, okay? Where does the money come from?
Yes, one of the big surprises to many people is that for a university like Stanford, only about 10% of our revenue actually comes from revenues from students.
10%?
10%. It is a surprise. About 22% comes from sponsored research activities. I think that what also distinguishes some research universities is if they have an academic medical center attached or a hospital attached to them. Academic medicine has become very, very big business. And in the case of Stanford, about 22% of the revenues come from really revenues that flow from the hospitals to the university for the faculty physicians. And then Stanford also belongs to a group of universities that are highly endowed. And, you know, the importance of endowment varies enormously across different universities. But in Stanford's case, the payout from the endowment subsidizes everything that we do. It accounts for about 22% of our revenue as well. And then there is annual giving is very important. And then there's a slew of miscellaneous revenue categories, athletics, the arts, rental income, conferences, executive education, and so forth. It's really quite an array of different businesses that exist within the enterprise.
Rental income. Is that for ballrooms if people want to get married there or something?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, ballroom wedding revenue is not a very significant source of revenue. But we do have a number of facilities that we use for conferences. Usually those conferences are sponsored by the university, and so there's revenue that comes in from people that attend those conferences. We also have a number of rental housing properties.
Okay.
And so Stanford is an area where the cost of living is just extraordinarily high. So the university has really had to invest very heavily in housing, not only for our students and faculty, but also for some of our staff. So we actually own a number of apartment buildings that are rented out, and that generates rental income.
Were you involved in purchasing any of those apartment buildings? Because that sounds like a fantastic move. Why build a dorm when you can just buy an apartment building?
Well, we build a lot of dorms as well. And particularly one of the things we had to do in the time that I was there is substantially increase the amount of housing we provide for graduate students, because graduate students couldn't afford to rent apartments in Palo Alto or the surrounding communities. So we added 2,500 graduate student apartments. But similarly for staff, I my organization, I had staff that would live two and a half hours away at a time when most staff still commuted to the office 4 days a week. Yeah, that was a huge burden. So we did build a lot of staff housing as well over my time there.
You talked about the endowment and the importance of the endowment. That has to come from somewhere. How do you go about what tools do you use to accumulate endowments? And in other words, how do you get those people to write those big checks?
Well, we are fortunate in terms of having alumni and other friends in the university that really value the work that the university does. And particularly what's very common is individuals who receive financial aid to attend Stanford on their own, who later have great success, feel a sense of gratitude, and they want to provide that opportunity for other students as well. So they might then endow a scholarship themselves. Or if they've had a particularly great relationship with a particular faculty member, they may want to endow a professorship. We have patients that have gotten life-saving medical care at our hospital who decide to make a gift to support research, and that may be an expendable gift or it may be an endowment gift to support it over a long period of time. But we've been very, very fortunate in the generosity of our alumni and other friends over time.
But my guess is that there has to be a significant development staff to be able to encourage that and facilitate that.
Yes, there is. The way we think about it is we have an alumni association that really tries to build lifelong relationships with our students from the time they come in as freshmen. And that is reinforced through annual reunions. There's lots of opportunities in local communities for alumni to get together. So we try and keep that close bond between students that have had an experience at Stanford and a sense of community over a long period of time. And then, yes, we do have a development staff that also builds those relationships. We have many instances where individual might give $100 a year for 20, 30 years, and then suddenly, for one reason or another, either a big life event or they've had sold a company where they'll make an extraordinary endowment gift to us.
You mentioned that tuition was only a small percentage of what the actual revenue is, but tuition has risen incredibly rapidly during the time you were there. Why did that happen?
Yeah, so. Really, the philosophy that Stanford has had, we have students that come from very wealthy families, and we have a very high percentage of students that come from low and middle income family backgrounds. And we have tried to make Stanford more and more affordable and accessible to students from low and middle income backgrounds over time. So for example, today, students who come from families with incomes below $100,000, we provide a complete free ride to the university. Students with families' incomes below $175,000 pay no tuition. They might pay for housing. So at the same time, you know, there are students, families of multimillionaires and billionaires, and we believe they should pay something closer to the full cost of their education. And even the sticker price does not cover the full cost of education at Stanford. So even those students still are being subsidized.
Let me stop you for there. Let's just think about that. Even the full sticker price does not represent the cost of an education at Stanford. That's a fascinating statement. How do you get there? In other words, what are the sort of costs that you're seeing that a student's education that outweighs the, what is it, $60,000, $70,000 of a current full sticker enrollment?
Yeah, the dominant cost is people.
People, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Probably 2/3 of our expenses are salaries for faculty and staff. And a couple of things have driven that cost up over time at Stanford and other universities as well. One is competition for top faculty. So increasingly our faculty, particularly in fields like computer science, economics, they have opportunities to go work for AI firms, the big tech firms, or they have opportunities to go work for investment banks and hedge funds. And so in order to retain those great faculty, we need to, well, we don't pay the same amount as a hedge fund or a tech firm, at least a competitive salary. I think the other thing that's really happened over time is we have made Stanford more and more accessible to students with disabilities and learning differences. And those students require more services and care than just students without those differences and disabilities. And those extra services have steadily driven up cost over time, particularly as a society broadly has become more aware and sensitive to the needs of those populations.
So just in case some high school seniors or juniors actually are listening right now, what do they need for an ACT or an SAT score? You know, we don't want to discourage kids from applying to Stanford, but what's the range, would you say, if you know?
Well, so first of all, Stanford takes a very holistic look at students' profiles. So grade point average, SAT, ACT scores are a factor. But what's also very important is the road that student has taken to get where they are today, what kinds of extracurricular activities they've undertaken, what their recommendations say about them, what they say in their essays. So while it is true that the average test scores are very, very high, I don't want to say to any prospective student that that's the only thing that really counts in terms of their application.
Now, and that's kind of across the board with universities now.
It certainly is true of the bigger universities. That's right. I also would like to say, though, for any student thinking about Stanford or elsewhere, there are just a tremendous number of universities in this country that offer great education. And it would really be a mistake to get one's heart set on any one particular university. It's there. You know, I encourage every student to look at a wide range, apply to a wide range, and identify a number of universities at which you will be happy, and don't just focus on a Stanford or Princeton or Harvard or any one of those in particular.
That's for all you Park City High, Wasatch High kids. Apply.
Okay. I want to come back to medical centers because, in a sense, they are completely different in kind than I would think any other sort of element of the university in terms of both the revenues and the sources of revenues, which can come from, you know, insurance payers and Medicare and Medicaid, and in terms of the costs. How difficult is it with respect to operating an academic medical center to actually have it break even?
Yeah, the whole area of medicine itself is incredibly complicated, as you say, Roger, because first of all, you have different payers. You have the federal government, which, you know, roughly half the patients at a place like Stanford are on government insurance, either Medicare or Medicaid, and you know, something less than half are on our private insurance. And you know, Stanford and probably every other major university loses tons of money on government insurance. Medicare and Medicaid reimburse at a much lower level than commercial insurance. So finding that balance of commercially insured patients is very, very important. The other thing that is important is, you know, more complex procedures, advanced cancer care, which is what academic medical centers do extremely well. That tends to provide, you know, better reimbursement than more routine procedures.
It also requires lots of resources.
It does require lots of resources, but there has been a national trend, Roger, towards more and more patient care is moving to academic medical centers in every region of the country, whether that be the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Mass General in Boston, or Stanford and UCSF in the Bay Area. And that's what's happening is the community hospitals are shrinking, and in many cases being absorbed into or being merged into these academic medical centers. So a lot of that is, you know, more and more patients want the kind of care that they can get in an academic medical center.
And different universities take different approaches to this. I know that some universities, obviously you need access to hospital staff for hospital patients for your medical students. I mean, it's a fundamental part of the medical student education. Why do you think that some universities, like Harvard, have chosen not to own their medical centers as opposed to a Stanford that does? Or is it history?
Yeah, I mean, there's an expression that if you've seen one academic medical center, you've seen one academic medical center. The governance structures are very, very different, and a lot of that is history. I would not profess that anyone is necessarily better than any others. And Stanford does own both its adult and children's health system, but they are governed with a lot of autonomy. They each have their own separate boards and leadership teams, and you know, it has worked well for us over time.
We would be remiss if we didn't talk about the importance of government funding, particularly for highly technical engineering, computer science, artificial intelligence. Talk a little bit about its role in Stanford historically, and a little bit about, you know, the kind of pressures that we're seeing at many universities from government policy now.
Yes. So the partnership between the federal government and research universities is in large part what has resulted in America's incredible prowess in technology and medicine, that we've really been the leaders in the world for the last 50 years in innovation in technology and medicine. And so much of the fundamental research so much of the fundamental innovation comes from basic research that's undertaken at universities that has been funded by the federal government. And it's hard to draw a direct line in terms of the ROI on basic research, but if you look at the long arc of, you know, semiconductor technology, AI, the development of advanced medicine, many of the innovations that we see today had their seeds in research universities 15, 20, even 40 years ago.
And you know, the relationship between Stanford in particular and some of the innovations of Silicon Valley is well known and pretty strong, pretty spectacular.
It has been spectacular, and a big part of that is the culture of Stanford is one in which we have a very open boundary between the university and Silicon Valley. So, for example, many, many faculty in engineering and other disciplines have taken time off from Stanford to start a company. And we allow them to do that, to take a year or two off and then return as faculty. We also allow all of our faculty to spend one day a week on outside activities. So many of them consult to these outside technology companies, or they may serve as board member or as a part-time chief scientific or technology officer. And so, you know, that, and then of course, lots and lots of our students go to work in those technology firms nearby. And so there has been a wonderful symbiosis there that exists over time.
Do Major research universities, are they ever able to capture revenue streams from the technologies that they're developing, and how does that work?
Yeah, so one of the people ask me that all the time. There's this imagination people have that, boy, if universities could only capture all of that value, it would be an extraordinary source of incremental revenue to fund the university. We do that. We actually have, for 60 years, had a technology licensing office where we take inventions that are developed with university funding, and then we license those technologies to new companies in return for either some royalties or some equity in the initial company. So, you know, Stanford's about a $10 billion a year enterprise today, and that technology licensing revenue averages about $60 million a year. So it's, you know, and we do it as well as anybody out there. And, you know, I would say we generate far greater returns from the philanthropy that comes back from the technology founders who've come out of Stanford than we do from actually licensing or trying to invest directly in those ventures.
Is that because there's a significant gap between the results of basic research on the one hand and marketable products on the other?
Yeah, that is a really big part of it. It's very rare that a technology that comes out of the university can instantly become a huge product. And yeah, you know, one of the things Silicon Valley is also known for is its robust venture capital community. So many of these new technologies require a lot of investment over time. They require counseling. It takes time to build it up and grow.
I want to ask about athletics. You mentioned athletics, and obviously the changes in the financial implications of university athletics are substantial. Talk a little bit about, again, what goes in and what comes out on the athletic front.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other great misperceptions about college athletics and football in particular is this enormous cash cow for universities. You know, across the country with hundreds of universities, there's maybe 15 to 20 that actually make money on their intercollegiate athletics program. Football historically has been the one sport that does generate revenue, and most colleges make money on their football program, although that is increasingly at risk as universities have to start are now paying the athletes, in many cases, millions of dollars. You know, honestly, I think one of the things that is almost criminal in this country is that in 48 out of the 50 states, the highest paid government employee is the coach of the state university football team. And usually the coach of the state university football team is making 10 to 20 times what the state governor is making, 10 to 20 times what the university president is making. You know, we've placed such outsized value on college sports and football in particular. Yeah, we're soon going to be in a situation where the quarterback of the college football team is making 10 times what the state governor is making.
Well, that kind of leads to another question. Colleges and universities across the country are doing everything they can to attract students. So obviously paying their athletes is different. But what if there's just a really smart kid that every university wants? How do you attract somebody like that? Can you pay a bright student to go to your school?
So typically you cannot pay a bright, that's a great question. Today, that doesn't happen.
Not yet.
No, scholarship, financial aid has been a source of competition, particularly for students from low and middle income backgrounds. So when there is a spectacular student who comes from a low income background, Stanford, Harvard, MIT, will compete in terms of the amount of financial aid, but that only goes up to providing a full ride.
Yeah.
However that full ride is defined. It has not gone on beyond so far to actually paying them a salary to attend.
Right. So you can't say, Harvard saying, hey, man, we'll get you a Jaguar. You know,
right.
There's your transportation part. And someone else says, we got you a Bentley. You can't do that.
That's kind of happening on the athletic front, but has not yet happened on the student front. But going back to athletics, I mean, one of the greater challenge with college athletics is the question of, are these athletes still students? And I think increasingly with what's called the transfer portal, where so many athletes are moving from one university to another, sometimes four or five different universities over the course of the career, it really begs the question of, are they getting an education at that point as well?
There was one casual comment made by Division I player in the last few months where it basically indicated that he's never been to class, but it's neither here nor there. Randy, thanks so much for spending the time with us this morning. There's lots of other things that I wish we could get to, and maybe we'll get you back. We didn't even get to touch on artificial intelligence. So, Randy Livingston, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
We'll be right back after this.